successfully navigated you guys from the eating area to the lesson area. And now that your attention has been fixed on the radiance of my glory, as in all of the eyes should be on me. I have a fragile ego, eyes. So tonight is the kickoff lesson for this entire youth camp. Tonight is the first lesson where we are going to teach you about what the well-lived life is. And winter camp, as we said before we even left, gives you an opportunity to get out of the distractions of normal life and to focus. And so in this area, away from your schools, away from your phones, away from your Xboxes, or if you're lame, your PlayStations, then in this lovely circumstance, it is in this lovely circumstance that we are going to present this to you. So, here's the thing. All of you guys are young. Basically, everyone in this room right now would qualify as young. And when you're young, one of the things that you need to consider is, how am I going to live my life? All of you are figuring out, where am I going to go? What am I going to do? What is worth pursuing and investing in? And if you don't make that decision, it'll be made for you by the passage of time. So right now, you have an opportunity. Because there's an old saying that youth is wasted on the young. Because there are people that they live for 60 years, 70 years, and they think back and they think, man, I would give anything to go back to being a junior higher, to go back to being a high schooler or a college student and do it over again. And so the question is, can you live your life now so that you're not asking yourself that question later? And that's what this camp is about. What is the well-lived life? What does it mean to use your time well? And in this lesson, I'm going to orient you. Because before we talk about what the well-lived life is, we need to talk about the wasted life. We need to talk about, what are the things that you're looking at now that you're thinking, this is worthy of my pursuit. This is worth my time. This is worth my life. We need to talk about what those misconceptions might be, and we need to talk about it now so that you're not regretting it in 60 years. So before I continue, I want to know, if you could talk to anyone from history, who would it be? If you could talk to anyone, yes.
Jesus.
Jesus, why? You're looking at me like I'm crazy. You're like, it's Jesus.
Do you know old Hebrew?
All right, how about another one? Yes. Who would you talk to?
Martin Luther King Jr.
Martin Luther King Jr. Why?
He had morals worth listening to. He was dedicated to his work, and he actually showed people equality.
Sure.
Equality within races or genders.
Yep. So you're looking at someone, you're like, that's someone with strong moral fiber. That's someone who made a difference. How can I do the same thing? I'm going to get one more. One more person. Red. Leonardo da Vinci. Nice. Why? Because he's cool. I'm into that answer, man. That's all I needed to hear. I'm into that, yeah. Leonardo da Vinci, Renaissance man, artist, inventor, big name. But I'm going to give you guys a bit of a... I'm going to tell you what I would talk to. I would like to talk to King Solomon. King Solomon is a character from the Old Testament that has always resonated with me. And I want to tell you a little bit about who King Solomon is. King Solomon was the king in Israel right after King David. He was the son of David. And what makes him unique is that he was given an offer. He was given an offer that no one else has ever been given. God shows up to Solomon and he says, at Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, ask what I shall give you. God literally shows up to Solomon and he says, ask me for something and I will say yes. Solomon could have asked for a lot of things. Like, think about the kind of things you might have asked for. He could have asked for a long life. He could have asked for superpowers. He could have asked for the life of his enemies. He could have asked for riches. Solomon could have asked for all of these different things. And when I think about what I would have asked for, what Solomon asked for is not it. But Solomon responds to this, and he says, now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of David my father, although I am but a little child. I do not know how to go out or come in. Give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind to govern your people, that I may discern the difference between good and evil. For who is able to govern this, your great people? Which, in case you're wondering, that was the right answer. Solomon is looking at this responsibility and he's saying, how can I be faithful to God in this? So even as a young guy, Solomon's starting out like this is a pretty neat, you know, track record. But it gets even better. God answers and says, perfect. And he says, behold, I do now according to your word. Behold, I give you a wise and discerning mind so that none like you has been before you and none like you shall arise after you. So not only does God say yes, but he's not like some genie trying to catch him in his wording. He says yes to Solomon, and he says yes in a big way. He says, not only are you going to get what you asked for, but I'm going to give you so much of it that no one is going to compare to you in the past or in the future. Solomon is the wisest man who has ever lived. And God says, because you asked for this and you did not ask for riches or the life of your enemies or a long life, behold, I give you also what you did not ask for. So God is happy with Solomon's answer. So this is someone who started well. This is someone who has access to a resource unlike anything else. And then you fast forward a little bit in Solomon's life and the home slice tanked like the Titanic. And at the end of his life, it says, so Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and did not wholly follow the Lord as David his father had done. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and for Molech, by the way, people would burn their kids alive for Molech. That's what his worship looked like. And that's who Solomon is building an idol for. For Molech, the abomination of the Ammonites, on the mountain east of Jerusalem, and so he did for all his foreign wives who made offerings and sacrifice to their gods. Solomon married 700 wives and 300 concubines, and that's a fat oof right there. And it says that later in his life, they lead him away. And there's a whole part of this story that we're not even talking about. But Solomon fell hard. And Solomon is someone who wasted his life. And at the end of his life, I would want to talk to him. I would want to have a conversation with Solomon and say, hey, you're the wisest person who's ever lived. And boy, did you blow it. What advice do you have for me to not repeat the mistake that you made? What advice do you have so that I don't end up where you are? And when I thought about that, I was talking about that to someone one day, and I realized that I have that conversation. That conversation is the book of Ecclesiastes. The book of Ecclesiastes is a book that Solomon wrote at the end of his life, looking back on all of the ways that he wasted it. And it's him saying, this is the mistake I made. Don't make it yourself. When you talk about, you know, Ecclesiastes, one of the neat things about Ecclesiastes is that it's written stream of consciousness. In the same way that when you have a conversation with someone, it's not like introduction, point one, point two, point three, conclusion. Like you'll talk about a bunch of random stuff. Maybe we're going to talk about like Pokemon, and then you'll talk about school, and then you'll talk about sports, and then back to Pokemon, and you kind of scatter around, right? That's how conversations go, and that's how Ecclesiastes is written. It's not written in a rigid structure. He's actually just working through the idea with you. And the idea he's working through is this. Is there a pursuit in life that is worth pursuing? Is there something in life that you and I could invest in that's valuable in and of itself? From a secular perspective, how do you live? Is there a way to live? And I'm going to give you the punchline. John 10:10. It says, the thief comes only to kill, steal, and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. That's a verse that we throw around all the time. But the question is this, do you believe it? Do you actually believe that life with Jesus is better than life without Jesus? Do you actually believe that the world system is here to kill, steal, and destroy? Do you actually believe that what the world and sin offers you is destructive to you? Or do you think you're giving something up to come to Jesus? Because this verse right here, if you understand it, is the book of Ecclesiastes. Solomon is going to take that first half of that verse where it says the thief comes only to kill, steal, and destroy, and he's going to dive into that with us. So the punchline right at the beginning, that is the book of Ecclesiastes. Life with Jesus is better, not just in the future, but now. And that's important. But we're going to go in, and one of the things that we see is that the first thing Solomon talks about in this conversation, and I'm going to kind of map it out because, like I said, this doesn't follow a normal structure. So the first thing that he talks about is pleasure. The first thing that Solomon talks about is pleasure, where he says, I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold of folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted them in all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves, and I had slaves that were born in my house. I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold, and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, understatement, the delights of the sons of man. So when you talk about living it up, Solomon lived it up. Solomon had access to everything he could want. He had access to money. He had access to a country. He had peace on all sides, so he didn't even have to worry about necessarily someone else coming in and taking it from him. Solomon lived life to the fullest. You're not going to find someone like that in almost any walk of life. Solomon had it good. And he kind of summarizes that, and he says, "And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept from my heart no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for my toil." And so now, Solomon's at the end of his life, and he's lived it up like this, and we're going to see, did that satisfy him? Is that the way to do it? Is this the fulfilling life? Is this the life worth living? And yet, what you see is Solomon says, no. He says, "Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun." And you might be thinking to yourself, well, why? That sounded pretty good. And Solomon actually explained it in the previous chapter. And Solomon says, "All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing." And the problem with pleasure is that it never actually satisfies you. You never see a movie and think to yourself, "Welp, I never have to see another one." You never hear a song without waking up the next day and maybe wanting to hear something else. You never see a sunset and you're like, "Oh, I'm good. You can gouge out my eyes." Like, you're never done. However much pleasure you have today, there is always more pleasure to be had tomorrow. And the problem is you get old and you die. And eventually an end comes to that pleasure. So the first thing that we see is that pleasure is not the answer. Pursuing a life of pleasure and wealth is not the answer. And we see some reasons why. First of all, pleasure never satisfies. That's what I just said, right? But then, later on in Ecclesiastes, as he's considering it, he says, "I said in my heart with regard to the children of man that God is testing them that they may see themselves as just beasts. For what happens to the children of man and what happens to beasts is the same. As one dies, so the other dies." And Ecclesiastes is going to deal with this issue a lot because it's an issue that we prefer to not think about. But if you're going to live the well-lived life, you have to live it in light of this reality, in light of the reality that life does end. And you need to be ready for that. So that kind of creates the second problem with pleasure. Not only does pleasure never satisfy, but pleasure ends with death. And so you see that pleasure is not actually the answer. And let me catch up in my notes, because the last thing I need to do is lose my place. But you see that pleasure is not the answer. And so the next thing that Solomon considers is he says, well, okay, maybe pleasure is not the answer, but what if wisdom is the answer? What if I live life well? Can I extend my life that way? And he says in Exodus, in Ecclesiastes 3, 14 and 15, "The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceived that the same event happens to all of them. And then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been wise?" Wisdom in this life doesn't help you. And that was the next thing that Solomon considered. So what's the next thing that we might think about? Well, the next thing is, what if I leave a legacy? What if I live my life so that I get remembered? I had a history teacher one time, and he said, "Get in my life in the history books. Now that's immortality." So it's okay. Solomon plays with that idea as well. What if you pursue a legacy? And the issue that you run into with that is in Ecclesiastes 2:16, Solomon says this. He says that, "For of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance. seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten, how the wise dies just like the fool. And so the issue with trying to make your life meaningful by having people remember you is that people won't remember you. For example, who can tell me who invented the internet? Who? You invented it? It was not you, Adelaide?
Congratulations.
Adam Lovelace, but she helped with it.
Potentially. So the people who invented the internet are two guys. One is named Bob Kahn, and the other one is named Vint Cerf. They created TCP/IP, which, for those of you who are not computer nerds, is basically the system that the modern internet runs on. As far as history is concerned, the invention of these algorithms is the invention of the internet. And the internet is indisputably one of the most important inventions that has ever been made. It has changed history, and you can't tell me who did it. These guys are still alive today, and you've already forgotten their names. But me and you, we're going to be remembered? Fat chance. Right? So that's the issue, is that you're going to be forgotten. So maybe you'll think to yourself, well, I can leave a legacy in another way. Even if people don't remember my name, the thing that I make can outlive me. The internet's still going to be here when those two guys are dead, right?
Are they dead?
Not yet. So, the... wow! So the issue is this, right? Solomon deals with that too. He says in Ecclesiastes 2, 18 through 19, I hated all my toil in which I toiled under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me, and who knows whether or not he will be wise or a fool. Yet he will be master of all which I have, and all that I have toiled for and used my wisdom under the sun. Let's say you build a company. Let's say you build a building. Let's say you build a country. You die, and the people who take it over from you are idiots, is what he just said. Maybe you were able to build the business, but the guy that comes after you, they can destroy it. The country that you build can be brought down in 100 years. So the issue is this, even after you die, the thing that outlives you won't last. But let's just say for a moment that maybe your name is remembered. Maybe the legacy that you create does last. Maybe, against all odds, you're actually able to do it. The issue then is this. Even if you leave a legacy for yourself, you don't care. You're not here to enjoy it. And in Ecclesiastes 20 to 21, Solomon says, so I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all of my toil and labors under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to someone who did not toil for it. And this also is a great vanity. Even if you leave a legacy, you're not here to enjoy it. So why does it matter? And so Solomon's looking at all of this, and he's like, okay, it's not pleasure, but it's not wisdom, and it's not legacy, and he actually loops back to pleasure. And he says in Ecclesiastes 2:24a, he says, there is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment. And he loops back to pleasure, but the problem is we already know that's not the answer, because that's where we started. And Solomon's going to keep doing this, where he comes back to pleasure and then branches out again, comes back to pleasure, branches out again. And then, after looping back to pleasure, what we see is that you're back to the place that pleasure will not satisfy. And he says, I said in my heart with regard to the children of man that God is testing them, that they may see themselves are just beasts. But it's actually not just that pleasure doesn't satisfy and pleasure ends, but also the world is not pleasurable. For example, he says, again, I saw the oppressions that are done under the sun, and behold, the tears of the oppressed. And they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors was power, and there was no one to comfort them. And I thought the dead who are already dead are better off than the living that are still alive. So Solomon looks at this, and he says, okay, I'm trying to find pleasure in this world, but the world's not even enjoyable. This world is broken. This world is filled with injustice. Governments aren't run properly. Relationships don't happen properly. And I'm going to try to invest my life in finding pleasure out of that? Pleasure that even if I can get it, it doesn't matter. And so Solomon goes on. And the next problem that you have with pleasure is that in addition to the fact that life is not pleasurable, you also have the problem that labor is not pleasurable. When you're alive, this is something that I heard and that I think is really funny. Even to keep yourself alive, you have to labor. You have to work a job you don't like, to go to a home you can barely afford, to watch a show that you don't even enjoy, so that you can sleep in a bed for a bit and wake up and do it again. And isn't that the normal cycle of life? Where work itself is not necessarily enjoyable, and oftentimes it's actually not. And Solomon says in chapter 4, he says, one person who has no other, either son or brother, and yet there is no end to his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with his riches, so that he never asks, for whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? Which, have you ever seen that? People that no matter how rich they get, they're not rich enough. No matter how many dollars they get, they still want more. They keep working. They keep depriving themselves of enjoyment so that they can work and get more. And Solomon says, that's worthless. That's absolutely worthless. So pleasure never satisfies. Pleasure ends with death. The world is not pleasurable, and labor is not pleasurable. So there's actually another thing that pleasure can't answer the question because of, and that's this. In Ecclesiastes 5:6, he says, let not your mouth lead you into sin, and do not say before the messenger that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry at your voice and destroy the work of your hands? Which, remember this, Solomon is trying to figure out, how do I live life only in this life? How do I live for this life in a way that's meaningful? And one of the things he's noticing is that if you live your life incorrectly and you sin, in this case, it's using the example of swearing foolishly and not keeping your oath, God's ready to judge you. Sometimes God judges you and he takes away your house. Sometimes God judges you, he takes away your income. Sometimes God judges you and you get sick. And so you actually, as you're living life, have to try to keep God appeased at the same time so that he doesn't just judge you and take away what you've built up for yourself. And Solomon's looking at this and he's like, well, that's another problem. If I'm pursuing pleasure, God's judgment can remove my pleasure. And that's another thing that I have to think about if I'm living just for this life, right? But then there's actually more. Another problem with pleasure is that there is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. And at this point, Solomon is looping off again, and he's looking at wealth. And we've kind of been like moving into this direction for, you know, a little bit now, but you can very clearly see he's talking about wealth here. You know, this is kind of related to pleasure. And he says, there is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt, and those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is the father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. And so the issue that you have is that even if you build up wealth, it is so easy for it to just go away. It is so easy to make a bad investment. It is so easy to get hit by a medical emergency that drains your finances. It is so easy for your business to go bankrupt, for you to lose your job, for COVID to hit. All of these things where this has been a reality for a lot of people, right? And the issue is that if you're living for wealth, it's not good enough. And so Solomon loops right back to pleasure. And he says, behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun. So we're back to pleasure. But the problem is, we already know that this isn't the answer because we started there. But we've looped back again. And so then Solomon considers something else. He says, well, okay, what if I had more time? What if I had more time to enjoy it? Is the problem not that I don't have pleasure, but is the problem that I don't have enough time to enjoy the pleasure I have? Well, okay, let's look at that. And then he says in Ecclesiastes 6, 3 and 6, if a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, and he also has no burial, I say the stillborn child is better off than he. Even though he should live 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good, do not all go to one place. And there are some people that they look at that out of the context and they're like, well, okay, if you have a good long life, then that's worth it. But we've already established there is no good life. When he's saying no matter how long it is, if it's not satisfying, there is no length of time where your pleasure will finally be satisfying. My uncle, he always used to say to me when I was like 12 years old, he'd say, John, how old are you? And I'd say 12. And he'd say, you're 70. And the issue is, if you had Adam in a room with my uncle, he'd look at my uncle and he'd be like, hey, Tony, how old are you? And he'd say, 80. You're 900. Time moves quickly. And the issue is that there is no length of life that makes this life worth it. And so then you see something else. Solomon loops back to something very interesting that should surprise you. Solomon loops back to righteousness. He says, maybe the answer in this life is if I live it righteously. Maybe I will find pleasure and fulfillment and meaning in this life if I'm a good person. And you have people that that's how they think about it. They're like, okay, it doesn't matter how much money I have. Maybe I can be like Gandhi or Mother Teresa. And if I'm just a real philanthropist and I give to charity, then my life will have meaning. If I pursue righteousness, then my life will have meaning. And then the problem is this. Ecclesiastes 7:15-16, he says, in my vain life, I have seen everything. There is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs his life in his evil doing. Do not be overly righteous and make yourself too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Which, that makes sense, right? Righteousness doesn't actually always help you. For example, if I'm a Christian in the Middle East, my righteousness can get me killed. And if I'm trying to find my satisfaction and pleasure in this life, it's not in my best interest to get martyred in the Middle East, right? So if you're too righteous, sometimes that actually results in hurting you. And so if you're living for this life, righteousness isn't the ticket. You won't find what you're looking for. But actually, it's not just that righteousness doesn't necessarily help you. It's that you can't actually be righteous. You can't attain righteousness. He says, surely there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. You'll never actually arrive at the point. See, I found that God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. And he's saying, you're sinful. You're never going to be righteous. Even if you could be righteous, it doesn't even necessarily help you. So he finds out, okay, righteousness is not the answer. And he's right back at pleasure. And he says, and I commended joy, for the man has nothing better to do under the sun but to eat and drink and be joyful. So we're right back at pleasure, but we already know that's not the answer. We already know that pleasure isn't the answer. And so this is the problem. All of this is taking place in a certain context. All of this is taking place in the context of life, where Solomon is trying to find fulfillment and pleasure and meaning in this life now. But the problem with this life is that this life is broken. It's not just that we are broken in this life, but this life itself is broken. And he says in 9:11, ironic, again I saw that under the sun the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to those with knowledge, but time and chance happen to them all. One of the things that you see is that sometimes there's extraordinarily disciplined people that just as a result of circumstance die homeless. And there are lazy people that as a result of circumstance get a fat inheritance and don't have a problem. The world is not built so that in every situation, people are actually rewarded in proportion to their character. Solomon is looking at life and he's saying it doesn't work the way it's supposed to. Even if you are righteous, even if you are wise, even if you live exactly how you're supposed to maximize your chances of having any pleasure, it doesn't even guarantee that it's going to happen. And that's assuming that when you get it, it'll satisfy you, and it won't. And so at the end of that, you see, problems with pleasure is that at the end, life is broken. This life is not built to give you pleasure. It's not able to give you pleasure. It's not able to satisfy you. And this is Ecclesiastes 11, where in Ecclesiastes 11, Solomon basically throws his hands up and he says, you know what? I give up. Cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. That's basically the same as saying, go up to a hilltop, take all of your life savings in cash, and chuck it off into the wind, and maybe when you get home, it'll be nicely stacked on your doorstep. Solomon's like, this doesn't make sense. This doesn't make any sense. Just do whatever and see what happens, because you've got no chance. Chance is going to get you anyway, regardless of what you do, so whatever. Like, this is basically Solomon ripping his hair out. He can't figure it out. And this is what Solomon answers. So at the end of this entire book, Solomon says this, if you want to find fulfillment and pleasure in this broken life, then this is your best shot. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes, but know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. And something that's important to note, the ways of your heart are sinful. The sight of your eyes are sinful. When you're young, the natural person looks at life and they think, I want pleasure. I want wisdom. I want to leave a legacy. I want money. I want a long life. And maybe they want righteousness. But the issue is that as a normal person, when you look at life and what it offers, the sight of your eyes is all of this in the context of a broken life. And the issue is this. A lot of times, when we look at the gospel, the way that we view it is this. We think, I can either have a really enjoyable, fun life now and then go to hell, or I can have a really crappy life now and go to heaven. And what Solomon says is you're going to live an empty, futile, worthless life, and then at the end of it, you're going to get judged for all of it. All those sinful pursuits you went after, all that time you spent trying to get heaven on earth now, you're going to get judged for that. And that's what you're trading your soul for? That's what you're trading your eternity for? This life, this broken life, this worthless life, this life that can never satisfy you, that's what you're going to give it all up for? Because Jesus says in Matthew, he says, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul? And we have this idea that, you know, this life is pretty valuable, this life is pretty enjoyable, and, you know, going to heaven is just right about there. Just a little bit better. And we have a hard time making the choice. Do I want, like, good stuff now or slightly better stuff later? And that's not at all the situation. Because the issue is that when you hear someone preach the gospel and they're like, you know, come to Jesus for your best life now, what they're offering is not actually your best life now. They'll say, hey, come to Jesus. Jesus will give you a nice car. Jesus will give you pleasure. He'll give you wisdom. He'll give you a legacy. You want to score more points in your basketball game? Come to Jesus. And that's a lot of times how they will share the gospel. And they'll be like, hey, get your best life now. But the thing is, Jesus actually is your best life now. But the reason that we have a hard time with that is that before we come to Jesus, when we're a sinful person, we look at life and we think we are giving something up to come to Jesus. We think that this will fulfill us and that Jesus is trying to take it away. But in reality, we're like heroin addicts that don't want to leave their needles for a life of sobriety. Would a life of sobriety be better? Yes. But is that what you want in the moment? No. And Jesus is saying, drop the needle, come to me, and I will give you a better life, but it's not the life you think you want. For example, imagine that you're in a dump. You're in a garbage heap. You're wearing ragged clothes. You're eating food that other people threw away. And then a millionaire walks up to you and he says, what are you doing here? Come out of this dump and follow me to my mansion. I'll give you clothes to wear. I'll give you food to eat. I will give you companionship and a family. And it'd be like if you looked at him and you said, you know what? Nah, I'm doing pretty good here. I had to eat rats yesterday, but someone threw away pizza today, so this is actually working out for me. I'm cool with what I got. And a lot of times when you hear gospel presentations, they look at God and they're like, God is so amazing. Eternal life is so good. Why wouldn't you want that? And that's good, and that's positive, and that's right. But Ecclesiastes is refreshing because it says, not only is God amazing, but would you look around you? Someone has come to get you out of this life that you're stuck in, and you're thinking to yourself, actually, I'm kind of chill with this. And Solomon's in Ecclesiastes looking at you, and he's like, are you out of your mind? Do you not realize? It's not just that God is offering you a life that is better than what you're living. It's that this life is so bad, you need to be saved from it. It's not just that hell later is bad, it's that this life now is bad, and the problem is that we are short-sighted. And so when we hear someone talk about heaven and hell in 40 years, or for some of us, when we're not expecting it, 2 days, we think, I'm enjoying myself now. And so Ecclesiastes is God meeting us where we're at and saying, okay, you don't want to give up this life? Take a walk with me and let's walk through whether or not that's actually the right decision. Because I'm just going to tell you right now, man, I'm going to give you another example, actually. Imagine that you were given a choice between getting $1 million or marrying the perfect spouse. Almost everyone I know would say marrying the perfect spouse.
What?
Almost everyone. If you came... Almost. So almost everyone I know would say marrying the perfect spouse. If you went to my parents, if you went to my parents and you went to my dad and you said, hey, I'll give you $1 million to divorce your wife. Let me tell you right now, my parents do not have a perfect marriage. I'm not saying they have a bad marriage, but it's not perfect. You're not going to have a perfect marriage either. Neither will anyone ever, and neither has anyone ever. My parents don't have the perfect marriage, but also if someone said that to my dad, he'd clock him. That's not even on the table for him. Same thing for my mom, man. No way. But let's change the example a little bit. Let's haggle, you know? What if I said you have a choice between marrying the perfect spouse or getting $1? Not $1 million. One. And you're thinking to yourself, man, this example's getting easier. You're like, what's with these metaphors, John? That's pointless. And I'm like, fine, let me try to make it a bit more even. What if I had a choice between the perfect spouse or you owing me $1 million? Where you have a choice between marrying the perfect person or paying me $1 million. Yeah, right? But the thing is, that is what our life is. We have nothing to gain. This life is broken and painful and worthless, and yet we look at this life and we say, you know what? That's like $1 million or spouse. I'm not quite able to figure it out. And that's because we're not seeing it accurately. And so Ecclesiastes looks at all of this, and he goes through this entire walk with you, and he says, this is not the worthy pursuit, because life is broken. If you're trying to find your meaning and value in this life, it's not going to work. Instead of trying to find your meaning in this life, why don't you start looking outside of it? If there is nothing in this world that can satisfy the desires and cravings you have, wouldn't it stand to reason that you weren't made for this world? Some C.S. Lewis for those nerds out there. But the issue is this, is that if you start looking here, all of the sudden, doesn't everything else make sense? Where I'm not pursuing righteousness for its own sake. I'm not pursuing righteousness for the sake of having an enjoyable life now. I'm pursuing righteousness for what's behind it. I'm pursuing wisdom in order to pursue God, not for its own sake. Right? And that's what Ecclesiastes finishes with. He says, and this is one of those situations where the chapter break was put in the wrong place. Because this is a single statement. He says, remove vexation from your heart. He's saying, don't pursue the things that you think you want. Don't pursue sin. Don't pursue fantastic meaning in this life that can't offer it. He says, remove that from you. Remove vexation from your heart and put away pain from your body, for youth and the dawn of life are vanity. And you'll see this word vanity all through Ecclesiastes. It means smoke or mist. If you go out into the cold air and you breathe out, the way you can see your breath for a second and it's gone, that's what vanity means. That's your life. It's short. So he says, remove that from you. Don't pursue that life. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. Put away that life. Pursue God. And the issue is, it comes right back to John 10:10. Do we actually believe that this life isn't worth pursuing? Because we hear that verse all the time, and we're so quick to throw it out. And Ecclesiastes is a whole book where Solomon comes to your level and he says, it's not worth it. So this is the thing. This is the wasted life. The wasted life is the life that you spend pursuing this broken life, trying to get what you can out of it, and then at the end of it, God judges you. But the abundant life? I picked that example of a perfect spouse. That was not on accident. As a Christian, as a person right now, my life is better as a Christian than it was as a non-Christian. And it's not because I have more money. I don't. It's not because I have a more comfortable life. It's not because I'm smarter. It's not because I'm more likely to leave a legacy. It's because I look back at where I was. I look back at the broken thing that I was. I look back at the anger, the confusion, the violence, and where I was as a youth. And I think, goodness gracious, God came to a dump and asked for that. And now, as a Christian, abundant life doesn't start at the end of your life. Abundant life doesn't start at the pearly gates. Abundant life starts now. I have the Holy Spirit in me now. I have access to Jesus now. I talk to the Father now. I don't have to wait. And eternal life doesn't start when you die. It starts the moment you become a Christian, and Jesus is offering that to you now. And tomorrow, we're going to take some time and talk about how do you get into this perfect life. What's that gate look like? And the day after that, we're going to talk about once you've come in, what do you do then? What does it mean to live the well-lived life? But the problem is, we can't have you coming into this thinking that this is one of two good options. This is not one of two good options. This is the only option. Right? So with that, let's bow our heads. Lord, thank you that you reason with us on our level. Thank you that you see the frailties and the short-sightedness that we as people have, where we are so eager to trade eternal life, that we are so eager to trade a relationship with God himself. We are so eager to trade that for a life that cannot satisfy, for a life that we were not made for a life that is full of brokenness and sin. Lord, thank you that you see us and you reason with us on that level. I pray that you would help each of us, that as we're up here, we would genuinely focus and we would consider the offer that you're making us, that we would consider the grace that you are extending to us, and that that would be an attractive thing. Lord, for the people up here that are not Christians, I pray that you would work on their heart, that you would show them the value of who you are, and you would show them the bankruptcy of what we pursue instead. And Lord, I pray for the people that are Christians. I pray that you would help them not to look back at the world that they gave up to follow you, thinking, man, did I make the right choice? But that instead, they would look back at that and be so glad you saved them from it, and that this would be an encouragement to them to live life well and to live life before you. And Lord, I pray these things in the name of our King Jesus Christ. Amen. Go for it. I got nothing else. Yeah.
So let's thank John for...